Good morning. First case this morning is United States v. Stanton. Appellant ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
The government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Appellant may argue.
Good morning, Chief Judge Stuckey and members of the court. May it please the court. My name is Captain Amanda Dermody, and along with my co-counsel, Mr. Mark Brueger, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class LaDarian Stanton. Chief Judge Stuckey, with your permission, I would like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. Pursuant to Air Force Instruction 363208, Airman Stanton entered into a valid agreement with the convening authority to be discharged in lieu of trial by court-martial. The plain language of this agreement was unambiguous. The convening authority violated this agreement when he approved the sentence of no punishment, leaving Airman Stanton with both an under other than honorable conditions discharge and a criminal conviction.
Is this a true PTA as defined the rules?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that this is a PTA under the rules for...
Well, it's not pre-trial. It's in the middle of the trial, and it involves an administrative discharge over which we have absolutely no jurisdiction. And it sounds like your man got what he wanted. He got an administrative discharge, I think, didn't he?
Yes, Your Honor, he did.
Yeah, was that a UOTHC?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, then, why are we here?
Your Honor, we're here because Airman Stanton did not get the benefit of his bargain.
Well, I'm not sure he had a bargain. Did he have a bargain? I don't think this is a PTA within the meaning of the rules, so I don't know what you're asking us to enforce. Some sort of civil contract floating around in the air or what?
First, Your Honor, it's our position that this is a pretrial agreement under the rules because this agreement was made prior to Airman Stanton's sentence rehearing. So just as a typical pretrial agreement could be made prior to a sentence rehearing, so could this agreement.
Okay. We can get into whether it was an agreement. As the Chief Judge said, there's a question about that. We can even get into whether it's pre-trial. Question I have, though, is under Rule for Court-Martial 705C, identifies prohibited terms of a pretrial agreement that includes cannot deprive the accused of the right to complete sentencing proceedings and complete an effective exercise of post-trial appellate rights. That seems to be the very basis of this agreement, if there was an agreement. So how, in looking at this, can we actually say that there was a pretrial agreement?
Yes, Your Honor. Under RCM 705, a pretrial agreement, I believe it's 705C2E, talks about the permissible terms or conditions. And under that, it includes the promise to waive certain procedural rights. So in this case, Airman Stanton waived his right to a sentence rehearing and to present evidence at that hearing. But even if this court finds that this isn't a typical pretrial agreement under RCM 705, which we believe it is, this court still has jurisdiction to hear this specific issue and to address the agreement in this case.
Counsel, if a pretrial agreement is before us and it precludes the conduct of a sentencing proceeding, what's the ruling in that case in light of the provision cited by Judge Olson?
Senator, may you repeat that question, please?
If a pretrial agreement is before us, let's assume that there's a pretrial agreement before us, and the pretrial agreement involves waiving the right to a sentencing proceeding, what's the status of that pretrial agreement? Either on review by the military judge or on appellate review?
Yes, Your Honor. So at the very worst case scenario, this court should find that there was a misunderstanding, a mutual misunderstanding as to this pretrial agreement, And the remedy in that case would just be simply to put the parties in the position that they were prior to entering into this pretrial agreement, if this court finds that, for example, there was a prohibited term. However, this particular agreement is a valid agreement under Air Force Instruction 3630208. And the Secretary of the Air Force promulgated that regulation for the specific purpose of giving the convening authority the express authority to do what he did in this case, which is to administratively discharge airmen in lieu of trial by court-martial. So the convening authority did what he's allowed to do within the mandate of this Air Force instruction.
Counsel, can I ask you about the district court opinion? I know it came out after you filed your brief, and so you didn't have an opportunity to address it. But in the district court, the appellant litigating against the government litigated the content of this agreement. And Judge Leon in the district court held that what he bargained away was not his conviction, not the finding of guilty, but instead only the sentencing rehearing. What do we make of that district court judgment? In particular, is it res judicata? Your argument is that he bargained away the conviction, but you've already lost in litigation against the government in the district court, where the district court held that what he bargained away was the sentencing. Are we bound to follow what the district court said?
No, Your Honor. This court is not bound by what the district court said. And really, the issue in that case was whether or not the court had jurisdiction over Airman Stanton. In regards to what exactly Airman Stanton bargained away, we believe that just by looking simply at the plain language of the agreement, the language in that agreement is unambiguous.
Well, I'm putting that aside, though, if you've already litigated it in the district court and the district court ruled against you, we don't review the district court, and this is a matter that's been decided. Do we just ignore it? And how does that work if there are two competing interpretations by two different federal courts of the same contract between the same two people?
Your Honor, the issue in district court was whether or not the court continued to have jurisdiction over this case. So we, since the approval of this agreement, we've advanced two separate arguments in the alternative before the court. The first is the one that was addressed by the district court, which was that the court no longer had jurisdiction over the case because the government had agreed to administratively discharge him. So the argument was that the government was unlawfully subjecting him to continuing military jurisdiction. That argument was rejected, and that's not the issue before us.
But part of the reason that it was rejected was because of an interpretation of what the agreement was between the parties. Isn't that correct, or am I misunderstanding that?
General, my understanding is that this court has continuing jurisdiction over this case outside of the administrative discharge. So just that the principle of continuing jurisdiction, once that is passed at Airman Stanton's first court-martial upon his sentence of a dishonorable discharge and 96 months confinement, that has continued since and remains until appellate review is final.
So are you suggesting that the district court lacks jurisdiction?
No, Your Honor.
But we have continuing jurisdiction, as did the district court, and the district court made a ruling on this this particular agreement. I just don't know how we can have two different federal court interpretations of the same agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that the district court was not addressing this specific issue and was addressing the issue of whether or not the Air Force Court had jurisdiction to continue with the case, is what our argument was before that court.
Can I shift gears and ask a separate question, which is both the CCA and the district court and also the government argues that the convening authority did not have the power to dismiss the finding because it had been affirmed. And I noticed, you take the opposite position, and I noticed that you did not cite 1203C, which is action when the sentence is set aside. And the last two sentences that seem to support your position that the charge can be dismissed, even if sentence rehearing has been ordered. Is there a reason that you didn't cite 1203C, or is it just overlooked, or am I missing something in thinking that it authorizes dismissal?
You are not missing something, Your Honor, and you are correct. So here, it is our position that the convening authority could have set it aside. However, in this case, that's not what the convening authority did. He didn't, you know, in some of the other cases, such as Montesinos, the convening authority actually did set aside the findings and sentence. Here, the convening authority did not actually set anything aside. So that's why, you know, we didn't further address that issue in our brief. But it is our position that the convening authority could have done that. However,
so your position is that the CCA was wrong when it said that the convening authority did not have the power to dismiss the findings?
Yes, Your Honor. But further, in this specific case, it's our position that once the convening authority approved the agreement, that was the action that he had taken. So he should not have proceeded with the court-martial by approving a sentence of no punishment. Once he approved that agreement, the practical effect of approval of that agreement was remitting the affirmed finding.
Thank you.
Didn't the defense counsel, in conversations with and negotiations with the government, indicate that he understood the government's position that the larceny conviction would not be vacated, but that he disagreed? So how was there some type of understanding here, some type of agreement that's now before us?
Yes, Your Honor. So in conversations between the defense counsel and Sam's defense counsel and the government, they disagreed over whether or not the convening authority could set aside that finding. However, they both understood that the convening authority was going to approve the agreement, and that was the action he was going to take. So where the difference in opinion was, we do not believe that's a significant misunderstanding. But in answering your question, Amundsen's defense counsel believed that once the convening authority approved the agreement, there would be no sentence. And by basis of there being no sentence, there could be no criminal conviction.
But the government had a different understanding.
The government, Your Honor, was not sure. My reading of the record is that the government was not sure what effect the convening authority approving the agreement would have on the finding. And if we look at some of the pretrial advice provided to the convening authority before he approved the agreement, there's some language about him setting aside the punishment, for example, and there's some language about the possibility of the conviction remaining or not. But that's not really important in terms of what everyone actually agreed to, which was that the convening authority was going to approve this agreement in lieu of court-martial.
But where specifically do you see that in writing? You state that everybody understood this, but where is that in writing? Where is that in the record before us where we can point to it and say, aha, there was, number one, a pretrial agreement, number two, a meeting of the minds about what this meant?
Yes, Your Honor. So in the record, what we have is Airman Stanton's request for discharge in lieu of trial by court-martial and then the convening authority's approval of that request. And so that's at JA-40 and JA-51. Both of those...
But what language? I'm looking for a specific language, not just saying. We've obviously all read that. I'm looking for specific language therein that makes it clear that there was a meeting of the mind.
Yes, Your Honor. So the specific language is this, quote, discharge in lieu of trial by court-martial.
Well, the words that give us, that says nothing about what the convening authority is going to do over here with this proceeding, this resentencing hearing that's still hanging out there. It simply says it's going to be administratively discharged, something which, by the way, we have no jurisdiction over whatsoever. So I repeat Judge Olson's question. Where in the record does it say anything that the CA agreed to abort the rehearing?
Your Honor, that's based on just that the simple language in the request and in the agreement that Airman Stanton would be discharged in lieu of trial by court-martial. That language, in lieu of trial by court-martial, means instead of proceeding with the court-martial proceedings. And that term, trial by court...
He got the benefit of his bargain. He got a UOTHC. Has that been executed, by the way?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay,
that,
he's out.
That is correct.
He's
yes,
out.
Yes,
okay. So he got his UOTHC. So once again, One, where does it say anything that binds the convening authority to do anything other than giving the UOTHC? And two, why are we here?
Governor, we are here today because the agreement was that Airman Stan would be administratively discharged in lieu of trial by court-martial. We are here because there was a court-martial in violation of that agreement.
So no, he'd already had a court-martial when this purported agreement was entered into.
Your Honor, at that time, the only thing that Airman Stanton had was an affirmed finding for the larceny charge. He didn't have a sentence.
Which is something, wouldn't you agree?
Yes, Your Honor, that is something. But upon the convening authority's approval of that agreement, the convening authority should not have taken any further action. He did not ask to approve a sentence.
Okay, this all sounds very much like equity, and we don't sit in equity. So well, anyway, go on.
Counsel, and we may be running out of time. Chief Judge may have a little bit of time after the time expires.
Go ahead.
In this case, the agreement is a matter of discussion in here. But what about the record of trial? What is in the record of this case, not the appellate record and all the additions to it? What's in the record that shows what happened here? You have a case that's been remanded by the Court of Criminal Appeals, and then you have an insert by the convening authority at several points dismissing charges, and you've got the decision to determine that the rehearing was impracticable, and it went away. What, if anything, do you have from the accused in this trial as to what was happening? I'm not talking about the external matters. I'm talking about the record of these proceedings.
Chief Justice, if you may, answer the question. Your Honor, the only thing in the record from Airman Stanton that goes to the specific issue is his request to be discharged in lieu of trial by court.
Is that placed in the record of the court-martial proceedings?
That was not a part of his original court-martial, no, Your Honor.
At the second court-martial, is that in the record of the second court-martial?
Well, Your Honor, his second court-martial never took place because this agreement was approved in lieu of that sentence.
You have a referral to a court-martial. Presumably you have a detail of a military judge who's going to hear the case. And the day before the case is heard, the convening authority intervenes and issues a sentence in the case. What's the authority for that? What's the authority for taking a case away from a court-martial where the case has been referred and the military judge has been detailed without engaging the military judge?
Yes, Your Honor. Chief Justice, can I
answer the question? Yes, answer the question.
Your Honor, the authority to do that is from the Air Force instruction, AFI 363208. Specifically, Table 4.1 of that instruction addresses when an agreement can be submitted and when it can be approved. And then it talks about, based on the timing of that request, what happens with a court-martial.
You have an ongoing proceeding here. How does that fit into 4.1? 4.1 appears to be addressing situations where the case has never been to trial. Here you've got a trial. You've got a finding. You have no sentence. You're right in the middle of it. How does 4.1 authorize the commander to do anything in this case without referral of the matter to the military judge?
Yes, Your Honor. So Table 4.1, Rule 3, I believe, addresses this specific issue in that once charges have been preferred and a hearing date has been set, which is what happened in this case. Charges were preferred, and the sentence rehearing was scheduled for July 24th. If a request is submitted, it's up to the convening authority to either proceed with that sentence rehearing or to delay until the convening authority takes action on that request. So in this specific case, the convening authority delayed that rehearing by a day, reviewed, and approved the request.
Charges were preferred, and a conviction was entered long before this proceeding. It's not clear to me, at least, how that table addresses that situation.
Yes, Your Honor, and our position is that this situation falls under Rule 3, and then further, AFI 36-3208 allows airmen to request to be discharged at any point in the trial proceedings, even in the middle of trial, as airmen stand in dispute.
So it's your view that a commander can take away a case from a court-martial, even after findings have been adjudged, even if perhaps there is an allegation of unlawful command influence or denial of victim rights, whatever may happen, the convening authority can just stop the proceedings at that point and say, we're going to keep the conviction of this case and adjudge a sentence of no punishment. That's perfectly permissible. With no involvement of the court-martial.
Answer the question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that in this specific case, once the Air Force Court set aside some of the findings, set aside the sentence, and authorized a rehearing, the case came back down to the convening authority for him to act on the case at his discretion. And he had a few different options, either order that sentence rehearing, find the sentence rehearing to be impracticable and approve a sentence of no punishment, or do what he did here and approve the request. So it is our position that the convening authority had the authority to enter into this agreement pursuant to that Air Force instruction.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for the government.
Judge Stippy, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Mary Ellen Payne, and along with Colonel Sean Speranza, we represent the United States in this case. As the Supreme Court made clear in Clinton v. Goldsmith, this is a court of limited jurisdiction with statutory authority only to review the findings and sentence of a court-martial as approved by the convening authority. This court does not have jurisdiction to review the propriety of appellant's administrative discharge. Appellant's administrative discharge is not a finding or a sentence of the court-martial.
Well, are we reviewing the propriety of the UOTHC, or are we simply looking at this sentence of no punishment that's hanging out there? I mean, admittedly, the counsel for the appellant keeps referring to this Air Force regulation, which, as I am from my days back in reading those things, I think only deals with rivals' request for discharge of legal court-martial. But what are we looking at here? I asked the appellant, and I'll ask the government as well. Why are we here? What are we looking at?
Well, the thing that you are looking at that would be relevant to the granted issue is the sentence to no punishment and whether or not the convening authority had the authority to do that. And clearly under RCM 1107, the convening authority did have the power to forego a sentence rehearing irrespective of whether or not there was any type of action under an AFI. The convening authority had the power to forego a sentence rehearing and to adjudge a sentence to no punishment. And that's what he did. And that's what this court should be only concerned with reviewing, not the propriety of whether or not an administrative discharge regulation was followed.
So building on that, I just want to make sure I understand your position. In terms of jurisdiction, are you saying that right out of the box, we should say, we don't have any jurisdiction to even open the memos here, the briefs that have been submitted here, or are you saying this court has the jurisdiction to look at this issue based on the issues presented and the fact that there was a court martial and so forth, but then punt at that point saying when it comes to administrative discharge, we have no authority?
Well, I think this court should not be looking at the administrative discharge paperwork, Your Honor, because I think that that is totally an irrelevant issue to this court, since there's no jurisdiction. A court-martial cannot adjudge a sentence of an administrative discharge, so
but,
it's not a sentence.
But getting to my point, though, Are you saying that we have no jurisdiction to even look at this case? Are you saying we have jurisdiction to look, but once it gets to the point where we're examining the administrative discharge, there's an iron wall we can't go behind?
Yes, Your Honor. There is continuing jurisdiction based on the initial court-martial and the fact he was a judge punitive discharge at his original court-martial, and this court's precedent has been very uniform and very clear in saying that no matter what happens at a rehearing, there is going to be continuing jurisdiction, and the case must come back up to the CCA, and then the court, obviously, the court could grant discretionary review. So, yes, there is continuing jurisdiction in that sense that the case is before you, but really this court should only be looking at the findings, which you didn't, this court didn't grant review as to the propriety of the finding of guilty for the larceny charge. But at this point, you could be looking at the propriety of the sentence to no punishment, and certainly that was within the convening authority's discretion to do, and that should be the end of the court's inquiry. The court should not look at the administrative discharge paperwork and try to determine whether or not that was properly executed under 3632.08. There are other avenues of relief that appellant could potentially pursue if he feels that that discharge was unfair. Including the Goldsmith, the Supreme Court made clear that administrative discharges can be challenged at the Board of Correction for Military Records, and that would be a much more appropriate forum than this court for adjudicating whether or not the administrative discharge was proper.
Well, then it sounds like you guys agree on this, that what's before us is this rehearing, period. We're not, as an old BCMR member, if he thinks he ought to have gotten a general discharge, he goes tracing over the BCMR, not here. But I don't think that's his complaint. Having had a judge punitive discharge, there's no way he would have gotten anything but a UOTHC. Bye. That's it. But it sounds like that the two sides agree then on what's before us. And they say, well, he didn't get the benefit of his bargain because he got a conviction and a sentence with no punishment. And what does the government say to that?
Well, the first point is that we do not believe that this was an agreement under RCM 705. There was no mention in RCM 705, there was no mention of RCM 705 in any of the paperwork that was submitted. And this court should not be in the habit of finding that parties accidentally formed an agreement under RCM 705. There's no indication that that was an understanding.
Well, assuming it's not an agreement under 705, then what is it? And as I asked the appellant, why are we here?
Well, it's a request, and a request for discharge, and then an approval of that request for discharge. It is not an agreement in any way that we would normally understand the word under contract law. So I think it's inappropriate to try to apply contract law principles to that. But what appellant is asking is for this court to find that there was some sort of agreement to get rid of the larceny conviction. And even if the convening authority was able to do that, which we do not believe that he was, I mean, there simply was no agreement between the parties that that was going to happen. And this court has there is a lot of precedent in this court that the convening authority may only act within the scope of the remand. And the remand in this case did not give the convening authority the power to get rid of the larceny conviction. And apparently the convening authority realized that and, in fact, informed appellant's counsel that they were not going to be doing that. So appellant doesn't really have any legs to stand on to come here and then ask the court to dismiss his larceny conviction.
May I ask about that? Does RCM 1203C2 give the convening authority the power to dismiss the charge of consumption of the brief?
Not in this case, Your Honor. And if I'm looking directly at that language, it says, if the Court of Criminal Appeals has ordered a rehearing, the record shall be sent to an appropriate convening authority. If that convening authority finds the rehearing impracticable, that convening authority may dismiss the charges. The language of that RCM says ordered a rehearing. The CCA in this case did not order a rehearing. It authorized a rehearing, which put that discretion in the hands of the convening authority. Rather than saying, convening authority, you must hold a rehearing. So considering that that preliminary condition was not met, we would argue that RCM 1203C does not apply in this case, and instead we're looking at RCM 1107, which says that the convening authority, if a rehearing is impracticable, may authorize a sentence to no punishment.
May I ask an unrelated question, which was the question that I asked the appellant's counsel? Which is, what do we make of the district court opinion? Again, I know that came out, I think, maybe the same day you'd already filed your paper, so you couldn't address it. You're arguing now that there wasn't an agreement, and even if there was an agreement, it didn't contain a term requiring dismissal of the larceny conviction. And that's the conclusion that the district court reached also, that what appellant had bargained away was the rehearing on the sentence. He didn't bargain away that this the conviction. What do we make of that district court opinion? Are we bound by it? What's the government's position on that?
Well, our position, Your Honor, is that reinforces
that. It certainly reinforces your position. My question is, do we say we agree with the reasoning, or do we say whether we agree with the reasoning or not, we're bound by the district court's interpretation of that contract?
Well, I think it reinforces that this court does not have jurisdiction to be answering this question. If this question can be raised and ruled upon in district court, I think it just goes to show that there's no jurisdiction here for this court to be wading into whether or not the administrative discharge is proper and whether it followed the guidelines of 3632.08. So, I mean, in that sense, I would say that it's not more binding because the court doesn't have jurisdiction in the first place to answer the question that the district court did.
If you put aside the notion that there's any agreement involved here, and you're just looking at the straight process, when someone puts in a request for discharge in lieu of trust, forget about what other things may have been going on about who was talking to whom. But if that request for discharge in lieu of trial is approved, isn't Captain Dermody's complaint really, and she can correct me on rebuttal here, but just her complaint is, look, you gave me my discharge in lieu of trial, but you still finished the trial. In other words, was there a trial in the lawful sense of the word at the time the convening authority decided to authorize no punishment or approve no punishment in this case? Do you see what I'm asking?
I think
she's saying, hey, look, I asked for a discharge in lieu of trial. You gave me my discharge, but you went to trial. And so the question I have is that, is there a trial or was there an actual trial in the sense of what we all come to think of as a trial?
I would disagree that there was a trial.
What's the process that the convening authority took in this case after the remand?
So after the remand, and there was some complication because there is potentially a rehearing on the sexual assault charges. That was authorized. So the convening authority did originally refer the sexual assault charges to trial for rehearing, along with a rehearing on the larceny specification as to the sentence.
Yes.
So those things by special order A-10 were referred to a trial by court-martial. Now, the convening authority, independent of any type of Chapter 4 request, dismissed the sexual assault charges mm-hmm. because the victims did not want to participate.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, the larceny conviction still remained referred to trial by court-martial by special order A-10 for a sentence rehearing. So there was a, still at that point, before the Chapter 4 request, there was a court-martial convened for the purposes of that sentence rehearing. And that sentence rehearing and that court-martial never took place because of the Chapter 4. So I do think that it is still correct within the language trial by court-martial to say that a trial by court-martial did not take place in this case because it was referred to, there was, sentence rehearing was referred to trial, trial never occurred. So I do believe within the plain language, there was no trial by court-martial.
Yeah, but it seems to me that's kind of the crux of all this. She has argued that that was a trial. You were halfway through the trial, and then I asked for this discharge in lieu of trial. You gave it to me, but then you finished the trial against me. Isn't that kind of the crux of what the real disagreement is?
I think that that...
She thinks there was a trial and you think there was not.
Right, and I think what the approval of the discharge in lieu of court-martial was to say we're not going to hold that sentence rehearing. It wasn't for the purposes of getting rid of the larceny conviction because based on law and the RCM, I do not believe that the convening authority had the ability to do that. And I think that just, again, brings us back to, well, what is the remedy? Even if there was an agreement that this court was going to try to enforce, what should this court be providing as far as the remedy goes? And if there was some sort of problem with the agreement, as appellant counsel said herself, what you do is you put the parties back into the position they were before any type of agreement was made. And in that case, that doesn't involve getting rid of the larceny charge because that was not part of the agreement. That was not something that the convening authority had the party to do. And as Judge Cookie pointed out, that would essentially make this court a court of equity to try to enforce something that was not part of a bargain and was not, or an alleged bargain, I would say, and was not something that was within the convening authority's power to do. And if we're talking about remedy, what would the remedy be to undo the administrative discharge? And I think this court cannot undo an administrative discharge. I think that you would all agree that that's plainly outside your jurisdiction to be able to get rid of an administrative discharge. And so I think that just again reinforces why this court does not have jurisdiction to answer the question of whether the administrative discharge was properly granted. And what this court should be looking at is whether or not the convening authority acted within the scope of the remand, acted within the scope of the code, and acted within the scope of the rules for court-martial. And clearly, the convening authority did so in this case.
Counsel?
Yes,
please finish your sentence.
No, I'm just, clearly, the convening authority's actions that he took with regard to not holding a sentence rehearing and approving a sentence to no punishment, that was clearly within his power, and that is what the court should be concerned with here.
As I understood your answer to Judge Sparks, the reason that in this case you had a scheduled hearing, that military judge, ready to go, and the reason that particular proceeding did not take place was because of the Chapter 4.
Yes. Yeah.
And so what if the issue in this case raised the question of whether there was a knowing and voluntary waiver of court-martial rights, not having anything to do with whether the discharge itself was valid, but whether the individual waived his rights in this case as a result of some problem with that Chapter 4. Why is that not before us, not for purposes of reviewing the Chapter 4, but for purposes of reviewing the apparent reason that the convening authority relied upon to terminate the proceedings without sending it to a military judge, or without letting the military judge proceed in the case?
Well, Your Honor, I think that actually under the rules here that the convening authority also could have reassessed the sentence under RCM E2B3, because that rule essentially says that if there are other charges that are sent back by a CCA for a rehearing and the convening authority decides not to hold a rehearing on the findings for those cases, and there's also a sentence rehearing that needs to be held on remaining charges, then the convening authority can just straight up on his own reassess the sentence. So I don't think that in this case the question turns on whether or not the convening authority found a rehearing to be impracticable.
Isn't that exactly what the convening authority cited? That somehow the hearing was practical on day one, it was impracticable on day two?
He did, Your Honor, but I don't think that he needed to say that in order for his actions to be lawful, because I think that he could have, under RCM 1107E2B3, just reassessed the sentence. So I don't think that at the end of the day that this court needs to be concerned with whether or not the rehearing was truly impracticable or not. I don't know that the court needs to review that determination.
What if we had a situation, and may I complete
my
question?
Time, Your Honor,
go ahead.
What if we had a situation, I'm not asking you to concede this, in which the express issue raised by the accused was, I was misled in the process. I didn't voluntarily waive my rights to a sentencing proceeding in this case?
I think, Your Honor, that a lot would depend on whether or not the agreement had explicitly been made under RCM 705. In this case, it was not. If there was something more explicit like that where this court could be sure that what it was reviewing at the end of the day was an agreement related to the findings and sentence, then I think perhaps there would be, but I don't think that's this case here.
So if it's not an agreement under 705, is it a waiver of the right to a sentencing proceeding? Is that what we have before us here?
So
he didn't waive his right to a sentencing proceeding in this case?
Well, that was inherent in the Chapter 4 request. I mean, I think that goes back to the question Judge Olson was asking of Appellant's counsel. How can this be an agreement under 705 when he's essentially waived the right to a sentencing proceeding that's a prohibited term?
So if it's not 705 and it is a waiver, who decides whether the waiver is valid, whether it's a voluntary, knowing, and intelligent waiver?
Well, I think that the DCMR could consider that when it's reviewing the propriety of the administrative discharge, but I don't think that this court can be getting into the business of asking whether an administrative discharge was appropriately.
I wasn't asking about the question whether the administrative discharge was appropriate. I'm asking whether the sentence could be adjudged in a proceeding in which the accused did not have a sentencing proceeding, and the reason appears to be that he waived that sentencing proceeding. Why isn't that waiver before us? Why shouldn't that waiver be evaluated by somebody, at least perhaps a military judge or someone else under the proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's because the convening authority had the ability to reassess the sentence regardless of what administratively the accused might have requested.
My understanding is that your answer before was that the reason is that this was impracticable, that is not workable, was only because of the Chapter 4, that there were no other circumstances under which the hearing was deemed to be impracticable that are before us.
I apologize if I gave that impression. That was not my argument as to the only reason that the convening authority agreed not to...
Is there any other reason in the record?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Is there any other reason in the record?
There is not. I mean, I do say that he said in, or I believe that in, it wasn't specifically the convening authority, maybe himself, but in the paperwork going back and forth, his legal advisors were talking.
And Chief Judge, may I ask one last question here?
Go ahead.
On page 45 of the joint appendix, the advice that's being given with respect to whether or not the discharge should go through says, the general court martial is scheduled to convene on July 24th for sentencing, although rule for court martial 910H1 permits Hughes to withdraw his plea at any time prior to the sentencing. I may have paraphrased the word there, but that's what's on the page. He had the right to withdraw the plea. Who can make the determination as to how that right gets exercised or not? Why isn't that a determination that's made by a court-martial or by a court-martial determining whether he made a valid waiver of that right?
Well, I think that, Your Honor, we're past that point because the CCA had already affirmed his conviction.
So the advice that was given to the commanders here was incorrect on page 45?
It's possible that it was not correct, but I think that what we have to look at is what the convening authority did, not necessarily the legal advice that he received, because the convening authority can always reject the advice of his legal advisor.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you, Chief Judge.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you,
Goodbye.
The crux of this case is exactly as Judge Park articulated earlier. The issue, the complaint of Airman Stanton, is that he was administratively discharged and still has a court-martial. And I'd just like to clarify, I believe earlier I used the term first versus second court-martial. It's our position that throughout the entirety of this case, it's been one court-martial. And despite the government's assertions that in lieu of trial by court-martial just meant a sentence rehearing, the plain language of trial by court-martial does not just mean a sentence rehearing. It means the findings, the sentence, and throughout final appellate review. And we can look at RCM 1209, which defines finality of a court-martial, to see that we have to get through all those steps before we have a court-martial completed.
Captain Dermody, you say this is one court-martial, but if that was the case, why would you need a new referral if this is still the same court-martial?
Yes, Your Honor. So there, a new referral was necessary because of the Air Force Court's remand authorizing the convening authority to re-refer the sexual assault offenses if the convening authority chose to do so. But it was a continuation of this entire thing is a continuation of Airman Stanton's court-martial. Another point to your question, Your Honor, is that the Air Force Court also set aside this sentence. So when it was coming back for remand, the convening authority had the option to refer those sexual assault offenses and also to authorize the sentence rehearing, and he did both in this case.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask, you heard the government counsel say that question about what's the remedy here. What is the remedy?
Your Honor, we are asking this court to set aside the findings and sentence and dismiss the charge and specification with prejudice based on the fact that Airman Stanton didn't receive the benefit of this agreement just based on the plain language of this agreement.
And is that based on what you believe is a theory that you cannot have a finding without an adjudged sentence?
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. And Judge Meg, just to go back to your question earlier regarding RCM 705 and whether or not this is a pretrial agreement, and I believe you specifically spoke about a provision in there that talks about you can't waive a sentence rehearing.
I believe that's Judge Olson.
Oh, I apologize, Your Honor. Judge Olson, under RCM 705, it allows an accused and a convening authority to enter into this agreement subject to regulations of the secretary concerned. So, of course, the regulation here is this AFI 36-3208, and that AFI specifically allows airmen to waive their sentence rehearing under this rule.
Counselor, are you suggesting that an Air Force regulation can override an express prohibition in the manual for courts-martial?
Your Honor, it's our position that the Air Force instruction should be read in conjunction with the rules found in the manual for court-martial. So these two, the Air Force instruction and the rules, exist together with one another. So the Air Force instruction, the Secretary of the Air Force promulgated this Air Force instruction for the specific scenario in this case to give the convening authority the discretion to dispose of a case administratively instead of criminally in accordance with the rules.
So the phrase in the rule for court-martial 705 that says the term or condition in a pretrial agreement shall not be enforced if it deprives the accused of a number of rights, including the right to a complete sentencing proceeding. Is your view that there was a complete sentencing proceeding here, or is that the Air Force rule somehow read with the with this suggests that the terms in the rule don't mean what they say, and that people can engage in an deprivation of a right to have a sentencing proceeding without it being enforced by the military judge?
Your Honor, it's our position that the AFI allows the convening authority to enter into this type of agreement with an accused. And worst case scenario, if this court disagrees and finds that the convening authority couldn't enter into this type of agreement, the remedy is to send the parties back to the position that they were prior to entering into this agreement.
Counsel, the Secretary of the Air Force promulgated this reg for RILOs. Say the Secretary of the Army has a different reg for RILOs. This is supposed to be a uniform code of military justice with uniform rules of practice. If we base something on this Air Force regulation, aren't we, you know, that's for the Air Force Corps. It's not for us. We have to behave uniformly. So, how do you answer that?
Yes, Your Honor.
You said they should be read in pari materia with the rules for course martial. But where's that leave us?
Yes, Your Honor. So, we are asking this court simply to enforce Airman Stanton's pretrial agreement with the convening authority.
I mean, you argue into it's a pretrial agreement.
Yes, Your Honor. It's our position that it's a pretrial agreement. And you're correct that the Army regulation and the Air Force regulation aren't necessarily going to be the same. However, what matters is what that regulation said, that it authorized the parties to enter into this agreement. And now we're asking this court to look at that agreement and find that the convening authority violated it by proceeding with Airman Stanton's court-martial.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Court thanks counsel for both sides. The case is now submitted. The court will be in recess until 10:45.